Hello, I'm Eric Brown, and you are listening to The Audit, presented by IT Audit Labs. Today, we will be speaking with Andre Champagne about his extensive experience in cyber and digital forensics. Andre is no stranger to the dark side of computer-based crime. Fair warning, though, today's episode touches on some topics that may be disturbing or upsetting to some viewers. Viewer discretion is advised. Joining in on today's conversation are IT Audit Labs professionals, Scott Rizdahl and Nick Mellum, as well as our podcast producer, Joshua Schmidt. Stick around until the end because you're not going to want to miss 1 second of this episode.
Yeah, Andre and I go back to the state of Minnesota's early days security operations center. I think he started in there as a security analyst maybe a few months before I did. I got there, I was halfway through grad school, and this was not my first security job, but kind of my first time like living in the fishbowl that is a security operations center. Andre was one of the first people to help me and train me and kind of tell me what the whole place was all about and what our capabilities were and also the things that we couldn't do yet and some of the bad habits and political barriers that existed at that time. And we both stayed there and worked there for a couple of years. I left the organization and Andre transitioned to a better job. But we spent our time in the trenches together at the Security Operations Center at the state of Minnesota. So one of my favorite people still from my cyber career. So I'm really happy he's here to talk to us. So Andre, maybe with that little intro, would you mind just telling us kind of your career trajectory a little bit and just kind of where you started, where you met me in the whole cycle, and then kind of where you're at now?
So currently I'm at the state of Minnesota. I am the supervisor for the Minute Digital Forensics Laboratory. I was actually hired by the state to do forensics, but when I got to the state, they needed help in the Security Operations Center, which was pretty new at the time. Mm-hmm. Didn't have a lot of people in there with experience doing, you know, security work and forensics work, so they threw me in there for a while. But eventually, I did crawl my way down to the basement and into the lab full time, and that's where I reside now. And I got a small team down there. How I got to the state quickly, and we can certainly dive in deeper. I started out at the Anoka County Sheriff's Office. That's a north suburb of the Twin Cities. And I was the head IT guy there for the Sheriff's Office for almost 18 years. I started dabbling in forensics around 2006. Decided that was where I wanted to transition full-time. And then in 2012, I left the sheriff's office, moved to the big city of Chicago, and took a job with the Illinois Attorney General's office doing criminal work, criminal investigations. Stayed there for roughly a couple years, eventually migrated back to Minnesota. I was a civilian investigator at the Wright County Sheriff's Office doing forensics, and then after that I came over to the state. So that's the quick career path for me and how I got to the state. And then, yeah, started working with Scott, and it's been nothing but joy ever since.
Especially when I left, right?
I was just going to ask if you only knew Scott as a colleague, or did he come up in any investigations?
Good one.
I couldn't tell you if he did, but I don't think so. No, Scott was, I couldn't have had a better coworker. Scott and I talked about not just work, but we talked about personal things and politics. And I think Scott will be the first to tell you that, you know, we don't necessarily come from the same political background. We don't necessarily agree on, you know, all of the stuff happening outside of work. Somehow I think it worked really well. We worked really well together. It didn't affect us at work, but we were able to jab each other, I think, a little bit, made it a little fun. But yeah, Scott was great to work with. And sadly, when we have great employees at the state, oftentimes they leave. And that's what happened with Scott.
It's the nature of the beast.
Thanks, Andre. This podcast is really all about me, and so I appreciate you staying on message.
Well, that's really entertaining to find out about your background, Andre, and then your relation with Scott. I've also found out you're a drummer as a musician myself. I was kind of interested in what kind of music you like to play and what maybe some of the names of your bands have been.
Yeah, I love playing drums. I'm a drummer, have been since I was about probably 8 years old, banging on my mom and dad's dashboard in the truck as we were driving up north every weekend. My dad decided that I needed a drum set when I was about 10 and told my brother to go out and buy one for me. My brother was a lot older at the time. Got me one, and I pretty much was self-taught. And then from there, I joined a band when I was 17, still in high school. Played rock, you know, top 40, that kind of stuff. We jammed out for probably 5 or 6 years through my college years, all over mostly central and northern Minnesota, parts of North Dakota. It was a blast. We were all young, all in our early 20s and having a good time. Had a few years off, then I joined a band called Shag Twin Cities. I believe they still play. Another top 40 rock band, cover band. I was with them for, I think all 8 or 10 years, which is a long time to be in a band. And then when I was, around 40, I'm in my early 50s now, 52. Around 40, I stopped playing in a band, but I've subbed in bands since, and I still jam out at home. Yeah, I think you mentioned, or in your email, you asked me about what do I play. So I play Tama drums. I have 3 acoustic sets. I collect drum sets, kind of like guitar players collect guitars. I have an electronic set. I have a lot of money wrapped up in my equipment. I've been collecting it, obviously, since I was about 10 years old. I still have most of my original stuff all the way up till now. It's a lot to store, yes, but I have a lot of land and a lot of shelf space. but yeah, I love playing. I love jamming. I'm mostly a rock guy. And that's what I do. That's what I do in my spare time.
That's amazing. I really like the name Designated Driver you had shared with me. And I thought that was a fun band name. Also, another fun fact is Scott and I were in a band actually in high school, our first band.
What?
I think from the time we were about 11 to 13 or 14 in that zone too. So
nice.
Full circle.
I had no idea. Circle. That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, that band was called a few things, but the one that sticks with me is Chunder, which is the Australian slang for puke. And we lived up to that name, I think.
It came from the song Men at Work from Down Under.
Yeah.
Came from that tune. So, fun fact, we're all kind of connected here in various ways.
So, in my bands, a fun fact, we had some real musicians. We had a drummer and a bass player, and then we also had, you know, threw in some guitar players.
What do you call a drummer without a girlfriend, Andre?
Homeless.
Uh-oh.
Homeless, yeah.
Nice.
Or 3 musicians and a drummer walk into a bar.
All right, let's move on.
All right.
The drummers don't like the drummer jokes all the time, but we want to hear more about what your day-to-day today looks like, Andre, and some of the challenges you face in your sector working for corporate forensics for the state.
Maybe just before we do that, could you just explain, Andre, what like cyber forensics is? I think most people who have any idea of what it is imagine that TV show NCIS. There was that character Abby with the long ponytails and the knee-high boots, and there's just always techno music pounding in her lab. tell us how much it is like that.
Yeah, I can tell you it's not like this, if you can see me, where you're like pulling stuff across some kind of imaginary
minority report.
Yeah. Doing this, and then boom, there it is. There's the evidence. There's the answer. It's not like that. So, you know, cyber forensics, it's a lot of things, right? It's IT work. It's incident response work, and it's forensics all combined, and then with a little sprinkle of legal stuff on top of that, and a little sprinkle of compliance stuff on top of that, and then you get cybersecurity investigations. What really happens in the day-to-day when we're getting into the actual work, and I'll step back and kind of give you a general overview as well, but for the work itself, it's identifying evidence in your case. And that evidence, right, again, it's not the moving around the screen stuff. It's logs. It's stuff that might be on your servers. It's physical devices. It's laptops. It's tablets. It's phones. It's literally everything that can contain digital information. We also will pull in on investigations, since we do investigations for the entire executive branch of Minnesota. We work with the Department of Transportation, right? Recently, we had to examine a device that sits on the roadway and track some information, but we had to examine that, and like, there's probably never been a person that's ever done a forensic investigation on one of those devices before. So we have to figure out, how do you examine that? How do you get the data? How do you extract the data? If you can extract the data, then if you can, how do you analyze it? What does the data mean? So there's a lot of testing, a lot of research that goes into the work. It's not always just you find your evidence, you pull it in, and you're able to just, you know, sort through it and do what you need to do. So this kind of work, a lot of testing, a lot of research goes into these investigations. You might have to learn a new skill, learn a new tool. You might have to interview someone. You might have to call a company up and try to track down an engineer that knows something about a device or about the data. So there's a lot of different things where an investigation can go. So it does keep it interesting, right? But also it can get very complex very quickly. As far as stepping back and just like what happens on a basic day, like a quote unquote average day, I would say an average day really doesn't exist, because they're all completely different. And no matter what you think is going to happen that day when you go into the lab, it almost never happens that way. Something else comes up, something you find in your investigation, you have to take a left turn or a right turn and go down a different path that you weren't expecting. So that is one of the things that I really like about this work, is that it's different. Every day is different. Yes, you're working investigations every day, but they're all different, right? And even a single investigation might feel like two or three if they take all these different turns. So that is one thing I like. A lot of variety in the job. But again, getting back to when I get into the lab every day, or when my examiners get into the lab, most of my examiners have anywhere from 3 to 6 cases on average at any given time. That can spike up to as many as 10 or 12,
wow.
Which we've had recently. That starts to become a lot of work for a single person. But they'll come in, they'll check the status of their tickets, you know, they'll start acquiring evidence if they need to acquire more evidence. They'll check the status of evidence that's being acquired. They will reach out to customers that have new requests coming in, and will do what are called scoping calls. So that's just, you know, what is the investigation about? You know, what questions need to be answered so that we can focus our resources, focus our time, and try to get to those answers as quickly as we can. And then identifying those evidence sources. Like I said, they can be all over the place. If there's physical devices, we need to get them oftentimes physically into our laboratory. So we have to coordinate that with people. Some data we can remote out to and grab. And if we can, we'll obviously do that. We'll pull logs. We'll do all of that kind of stuff. And then once you get your data, then the examiners will throw that into, you know, whatever tools they want to use for that case. And they have to process that data, right? The processing could take hours. It could take days or weeks, depending on, how much processing we're doing, how much data there is. So these are all things that we're doing when we get into the lab every day and just kind of moving our cases forward. And then when it gets to doing analysis and report writing, right, as a human being, we have one brain, one set of eyes, one pair of hands. You can only do analysis on one case at a time. And that's where the bottleneck comes, right? That's where you have to focus your energy on one case to do that work. So then we'll do the analysis and then report writing. I do want to touch on this a little bit because report writing is that one area, I think, in all of forensics and probably even in cybersecurity and general incident response that is kind of ignored. It's poo-pooed. It's not talked about. There's no time or energy spent on it. And I would argue it's the most important phase of your investigation. If you can't communicate your findings to your audience, then it doesn't matter what you found. It doesn't matter how much work you put into the investigation. If you can't communicate it, it doesn't matter. So I spend a lot of time and a lot of focus in our laboratory with my team doing peer reviews on reports to improve report writing skills. We've developed templates for the examiners to follow to help them be consistent in the look and the feel of our reports. So our customers are accustomed to a standard look and feel, and they know how to interpret our reports when they get them. But this is a big thing in forensics that's ignored. I talk about this all the time. Wherever I go, whatever audience I'm in front of, my peers, when I go to vendor outings and webinars and seminars, what does your tool do for reporting? How can it give me data that I can put into my report that will make sense? And again, there's just not a lot of focus on this, but in my lab, reports are like the number one thing that we focus on at the end of the day because they're the most important.
So, Andre, a couple questions for you, and thanks for elaborating on that. On the report writing side, do you use any artificial intelligence yet to help with the report writing or to help pull the data together?
No, currently we don't do anything like that. Our report writing now consists of, again, we have a template, right? So it has a structure. And then each examiner, depending on the investigation, because every investigation is pretty unique, will determine, you know, what information needs to go into the different sections of the templated report. If there's sections of the report that need to be removed that are not relevant for that particular investigation, we pull reports out of our individual tools. Generally, that they're not that great. They're like Excel spreadsheet reports, or they're cheesy HTML reports. But we get the data that we want out of our tools, and then we have to massage it to make it look pretty, to make it understandable, and then we put it into our reports. So reports are, all of our reports are peer-reviewed by someone else in the lab. They're peer-reviewed for administrative things like just page numbers, formatting, spell checking, grammar, those kind of things. And then they're peer-reviewed from a technical perspective, right? Is what you're communicating, does it make sense? Is it accurate? Did you put the right stuff in your report? And then really the third thing is it readable by the average person? Are they going to be able to get something out of your report? Because our reports at the end of the day, they may go to executive leadership. They may go to a jury, right? An attorney may need to read them. A judge may need to read them. And these people are not forensic experts at the end of the day, right? So we have to communicate highly technical analysis that we've done in our findings, and we have to put it in the report so that another forensic examiner that is reviewing it will understand that we know what we did, right, and that it's accurate. And then we also need to put it in there in such a way that someone with no forensic experience can read it and go, oh, that makes sense. I understand that.
Right.
So the bottom line is, no, it's a very manual process, and we could spend hours or days just writing a report.
We talk about that same thing of the being able to articulate clearly as being able to explain some of the things that we do at the Thanksgiving table, right? So, you know, you show up family gathering. Could we explain what we do day to day to the average person around the table? And sometimes that's hard to do, especially when we get into some of these topics like quantum computing that we had on a couple episodes ago. That's tough to talk about. But Andrew, what I wanted to ask you as well is when the examiner is preparing these reports, would they ever get called to be the expert witness to defend the report, or does somebody else do that?
Yes, they might be called to court or to a deposition or to one of many other legal types of settings to go over the report, defend their findings, or explain their findings. Yes, absolutely. For me, it happens about once a year on average. So it's not something that happens a lot, but it does happen.
And for the listeners, can you just elaborate and give a little color as to what sort of things you're dealing with? Are we talking about, you know, there was some data leaked from a site? Are we talking about somebody hit a spy cam somewhere? Are we talking about somebody may have stolen some credit card numbers? Like, what's the meat of the matter? What are you digging into on, say, your last three or four cases?
So quick answer is all of those things you just mentioned, yes, yes, and yes. So the things that we will get involved with are all over the place. I'll start off with, we will do the actual cybersecurity investigation. So that's a potential data breach. Someone hacked a server. Someone went into a state website that was insecure and changed, you know, the data that's displayed on that server, or defaced the website, as we like to say. So we get involved with that, servers that are hacked, and then, you know, obviously malware, ransomware attacks, things that are coming in through phishing emails that then spread to other assets throughout the organization. So we'll get involved with those investigations. And then really another big thing that we do, though, is we do internal investigations or HR investigations. So this is what our state employees doing, right? What are they doing, and are they doing bad things? Could be they're working a second job on state time, right? It could be that they're using state assets for personal use. It could be that they're destroying state data because they're about to get fired and they have a big chip on their shoulder. It could be that they're stealing data outright and exfiltrating it off to their personal email or a box.com account or a Dropbox account, and maybe they're selling it to a vendor or to even bad actors. So these are all things that we deal with and investigate. We also have people, unfortunately, you know, surfing porn, right? So we do those investigations. And some of these investigations turn into criminal investigations, right? At some point where it might go beyond just a policy violation or some kind of regulatory issue, but it might actually be a criminal issue. So in those cases, we will work closely with external law enforcement, whether it's the BCA here at the state, FBI, ATF. We deal with a lot of different organizations outside as well on some of our cases.
Whenever we're surfing porn at work, we just say it. We're testing the security.
Yeah, well, yeah, that doesn't work at the state.
That's why Scott's not there anymore.
Yeah, we did have a big drop off in data exfiltration after Scott left, and I don't know what that was all about, but yeah,
Honor, this is a lot of good information here. I think one thing that's sticking out to me is, or I'm curious about, is what tools are you guys using, or have you found one that's maybe more specifically, you know, has led to, you know, better findings, or what are you guys using to be effective?
we use many, many tools, and I think you're going to find that any or most digital forensics laboratories are going to have a variety of tools simply because there's so many different types of devices and data out there, and they're all organized and structured differently, that you really need to have tools that are designed for specific file systems, for specific operating systems, for to be able to read specific types of logs. So we use a variety of tools. We do have enterprise tools that the enterprise IT teams roll out. So we have, like, you know, an endpoint tool for detecting malicious activity on, you know, devices. We have different logging going on the network for network traffic. So we have lots of enterprise tools, and we pull reports from them to see, you know, are we seeing strange things as far as data crossing our network or coming in or out of our network, those type of things. We look at normal logs like Windows logs, right, and SQL database logs. So we have tools that will parse those out that are specific to those types of logs. And then we use a lot of the industry standard tools that most digital forensics laboratories use. We use Magnet Axiom. That's one of our primary tools.
Familiar.
We use OpenText Ncase. That's an excellent tool for deep diving into security events. I love that tool for specifically for that. We have X-Ways Specialist or WinHex Specialist. That's another good deep diving tool. We use Cellebrite and UFED for mobile phones and mobile devices. We also have Forensic Explorer. It's kind of a niche tool for us, but we use that to launch VMs. Like when we get a VM clone, we can throw it into that tool and we can actually spin it up and see what's going on the live device, but in a forensically sound environment. And then we have probably, you know, another dozen or two dozen small utilities and smaller tools to do like Mac forensics and some other things in our lab. So we have a lot of tools. And with that, you know, we're asking our examiners to know a lot of tools, and therefore they have to spend a lot of time testing, a lot of time training and understanding how the tools work.
Yeah, I was actually just going to ask that if everybody was expected to be, you know, an expert in all those tools, because that's quite the list that you named off. One quick follow-up that I was just thinking about when you were listing those tools off is, earlier you had mentioned that you had migrated to Chicago for some time and then back to Minnesota. I guess just curious on, did you notice a difference in cases that you might have in Chicago versus Minnesota or vice versa?
I was specifically doing criminal cases in Illinois, and then I did criminal cases back here in Minnesota. So I'll talk about that first.
Sure.
The main difference there is, I mean, it's not forensics, right? Forensics is forensics. Doesn't matter whether you're doing it here, there, you know, today, tomorrow. But the difference is how the laws are written and how the courts react to different crimes. I'll give you an example. In Illinois, we would work a child porn case. And if you worked it in the northern half of the state, which is Chicago area, that side of the state, and you had a case, and let's say that person, let's say they get a year probation, 6 months in jail for their particular child porn crime. You take that same crime in the same state of Illinois, but you go down to Springfield in the southern half of the state, that same crime going into a court, that person may get 10 years in jail with 20 years probation.
Oh, wow.
That's how radically different things are handled just in within that one state. And then when you're comparing Illinois to Minnesota, I guess the only thing I'll say is Minnesota is generally much more lax on these crimes.
Oh, interesting.
Illinois has much tougher penalties for child porn. But the work is really not any different, right? It's just the court process, what judge you get in front of, right? And then what the penalty actually ends up being.
Yeah. Andre, I just wanted to ask how often you find that you're working on a case or your examiners are working on a case and they just flat out don't have enough evidence. They can't process the evidence for some reason, or for whatever reason, it just sort of falls apart before it would get to the point where it could be presented in court or whatever the outcome would be.
There is a lack of, you know, some types of evidence, some types of logging for certain types of investigations that just don't exist, right? We're just, at least in our environment, or the environment at my current employer. And really that, it's like that in a lot of places, right? Because there's so much data going around, right? Transversing these networks, so many different, you know, types of things going on with employees and staff and different applications that, boy, if you're tracking everything, I mean, good for you, and that's great, and it's great for investigation purposes, but it's a lot of storage, it's a lot of work, it's a lot of tools, it's a lot to maintain, right? You got to have experts on staff that know what they're doing, you know, upgrades and updates with systems, and then things change, and then you got to tweak to keep up on things. So it's a lot of work. There's been great strides in this area in where I work now. And I think probably across most organizations in the last, you know, 5 to 10 years, as tools become cheaper, things maybe start moving towards some standardization and how logs are built and defined, and they can be pulled into these data logging compliances, right, where it's easier to get at them and sort through them and do things with them. But yeah, it can be difficult in some cases, absolutely, to find all the answers that we really want to find. But generally there's something we can put our hat on and say, well, you know, we may not have all the answers, but we have these answers here. And then, you know, sometimes that's the best you can do, right?
You had mentioned that most of the people you work with are examiners. What does it take to become an examiner?
Yeah, what does it take to become an examiner on my team or in general? I'll give you Andre's preferred qualifications to be a digital forensic examiner doing this kind of work. You have to have a strong IT background. Now, I know my counterparts that I've worked with in law enforcement that come up through traditional law enforcement ranks will probably have a large argument with me over this, right? But I think you have to have a strong IT background, because everything we're doing in this realm is related to information technology stuff, right? It's computers, it's phones, right? It's smartphones, it's tablets, it's logs going across the network. It's understanding ports and protocols, and you know, understanding hex, all of these things, right? And how do you tear apart a specific type of laptop? What if it has storage medium that is non-removable, right? What's the difference between a 512K sector and a 4K sector? Now, I'm getting in the weeds here a little bit, right? And I'm not expecting everyone here to even understand all of this stuff. But these are the things a forensic examiner needs to know, right? So IT background, strong, diverse IT background, I think that's a must. That opens up the first door for you, for some labs that might be willing to train you further, right, and give you specialty training to make you an examiner. But beyond that, certifications, there are certain forensic certifications that are helpful. There's some private organizations like IASIS, they have a certification. It's really big in law enforcement circles, but you don't have to be in law enforcement to go through their certification. It's well known in the industry. And then you can look at like all of the SANS certifications. A lot of those are excellent, not just for, you know, doing forensics, but just doing incident response and other types of security work. So SANS courses, I would highly recommend. There are some 2- and 4-year degrees, and I will caution people here. There is a big difference when you go to colleges in what you get for an education in forensics. And do your research ahead of time. Make sure you know what you're getting into. Make sure that the degree you're getting is actually going to teach you something and be marketable. There was a lot of people going and getting degrees 5-10 years ago when they first started coming out with digital forensics degrees. where you would look at the curriculum, or I would look at the curriculum, and there was one forensics course in a four-year degree, one. But they called it a digital forensics four-year degree, and guess what? Those people are having a tough time getting a job because they don't have tangible skills, right? You have to actually know something in this field, right? You can't just have a nice, pretty degree hanging on a wall. You actually have to know how to do the work. So just be careful before you spend tens of thousands of dollars on know what you're getting into. A lot of times you can just go get a certificate or a two-year degree at a college that's hands-on for almost all of the courses and actually learn some skills. That's the way to go. If you're going to look at a four-year degree, make sure it's one that is well-known, good recommendations, people are finding jobs, et cetera. So do your research.
And do the people that work for you need to be in law enforcement?
No, you don't need law enforcement experience. Like I said, you need a healthy IT background. Hopefully you've had some forensic experience before you get on my team, but I ask a lot from the people on my team. I don't really have like junior examiners and in a tiered structure because I have a small team. So everyone that comes on my team needs to really know what they're doing and can run a case from start to finish. But bigger labs, right? Bigger labs will bring in junior analysts with less experience and then help train them up, right? And give them a career path. So don't think you have to have a lot of forensic experience going in. It all depends on where you're going to get a job, right? And what your employer is willing to do with you. But obviously it does help. I will mention one additional thing. And I think this is probably just good in advice in general for people in the job market, but I'll talk specifically here about forensics. Do something that sets yourself apart from everybody. And what I mean by that is, okay, you know, let's say everybody has IT experience and everybody has some forensic experience, but learn how to script, learn some Python, learn some PowerShell, right? Learn some other skill that sets you apart, but yet an employer will look at that like, yes, I can have this person do some other stuff, right? They can help automate things in the lab. They can help write some tools in the lab that do things that our consumer-based tools that we're purchasing don't do, right? So again, try to set yourself apart. Try to get some experience in an area that other people don't have. Even if it's like a forensics course or something that maybe is like database forensics, for example, I'm just throwing that out there. A lot of people don't have necessarily specific training on database forensics, but if you decide to go out and take a course on that and put it on your resume, you're going to stand out, right? You're going to be different. So I highly recommend you do those type of things. And if you're not really sure about what things might set you apart, then find someone like myself, find a mentor, find someone you can talk to and say, hey, you know, what other things can I do to land a job? Or, you know, hey, I've applied for a bunch of jobs, but I'm not really getting past the first interview. Like what can I be doing differently? And then just, you know, try to work on that.
That's excellent advice. Thanks, Andre. Eric, did you have any other more follow-ups before I move us along?
I've probably got a lot, but I would be interested in hearing some of the stories too.
Yeah, you kind of had mentioned some of your time with law enforcement in Illinois and, you know, kind of how that compares to Minneapolis. But we'd, you know, for our listeners that are interested in getting involved in forensics work, love to hear some cases that you've worked on that stand out and that might be informative for our audience.
Yeah, we could talk cases all day. So I think we have a few that we've, I think, vetted. Which are some of my more favorite ones to talk about. We'll start out with the arson investigation, if you don't mind. So, you know, I guess let's just pause for a moment and let's understand when you're doing forensics in a corporate environment like I do today, you're dealing with, you know, HR cases, you're dealing with the cybersecurity hacks and that kind of stuff, right? But when you're doing forensics on the criminal side for law enforcement, the cases are completely different. Generally, you're never doing or almost never doing internal investigations. It depends. You're generally not doing hardcore cybersecurity investigations. But what you're doing is arson investigations, fraud investigations, CP investigations. You're doing criminal sexual conduct investigations, homicide investigations, right? All of the things you see on TV, right? All the crimes going on, that's the stuff law enforcement is working on. So in this first case, I worked an arson case. This was a case here in Minnesota. There was a fire in a townhome, and thankfully it did not spread and kill anybody, right? Because townhomes, they're connected. But there was this fire in a townhome. Our people went on scene. They took photographs, collected evidence, and our detective came knocking on the door and said, "Hey, Andre, I have a phone for you in this arson investigation. I need you to look at it. Tell me what you find." We sat down, talked about some of the basics of the investigation, who was involved, what they know about it, what happened, all of that stuff. I got a copy of, you know, the report, date, time, when things happened, all of this good stuff. And I got the phone. And I do remember this phone very, very well. It was a white phone, but that's not why I remember it. I remember it because it was a Windows-based phone, which are very, very rare. And we didn't get a lot of those in the laboratory. Everything was Android or iOS, right?
The and Windows then, should have made it real easy to get into.
Yeah, so Windows. So that's why I probably will always remember this case, just because it was a Windows-based phone. So I grabbed the phone. You know, we did all of our exchange, evidence exchange, chain of custody, all of that good stuff. I did use a Celebrate on this particular device, and I was able to acquire all of the logical data on the device. I did not need a physical image on this particular device, but I was able to retrieve all of the logical information. And for those of you that don't really understand the difference between a physical and logical is anything when you're on the phone that you can see. That's what I was able to pull out, right? And then a physical, if there was stuff that was deleted that, you can't see it anymore, a physical extraction would allow you to see or potentially see some of that data. So I made a logical of this particular phone. So then Andre does what he normally does, is he parses that out, starts looking at the phone. You know, I'm going to be looking at communications, right? I'm going to be looking at internet history. I'm going to be looking at videos, images, all the different categories of data that one might see on a phone. For this particular phone, I got to the photo piece, right? The images. I'm looking at the images on the phone. And I'm scrolling through the images, and I remember it like it was yesterday. And all of a sudden, I came to a whole bunch of photos, and they were photos of what appeared to be like collectible toys and different types of collectibles, right? All boxed up, nice and neat. They were against a wall, and photos taken, right, with the camera on the phone of these particular collectibles. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. Why are there all of these photos on here of all these collectibles, right? So I'm doing what any good forensic examiner / investigator would do. I'm scratching my head. I'm thinking, this is kind of weird. So I start looking at the date and time stamp of the photos, and I go, oh, interesting. That was a week before the arson. So I went to the next step, and I was like, well, let's look at the metadata for these particular images. They were JPEG images. Sometimes JPEG images have metadata. I looked at the metadata, and I found something very, very interesting. They all had GPS coordinates tagged to them, every last one of them. You don't often see this on phones, especially back then. This case was probably around 2014. And at that time, not all of these smartphones were tagging with GPS. But this Windows phone was tagging very reliable GPS coordinates on these images. So I'm like, yes, I have another breadcrumb to follow. Right. So I took those GPS coordinates and I, again, went off to the Googler and I was looking at them and mapping them out, and they all came back to one address in a city, a couple cities away from where the arson happened. All of them, all these photos came back there. So now, like, I want to know, okay, what's particular about that address, right? Because it's not the arson address, it's a different address. So thankfully, since I worked in law enforcement and I had easy access to property records, got a name of a person that was a family member's address for the person we were investigating. Okay, that makes sense. Bingo, got it. He was taking photos of all of his high-end collectibles at the residence of the person that he's related to, a couple cities away, a week before the arson, because he was going to do insurance fraud, right? He wanted to collect money. Bad news for him, he didn't know. He was tagging his photos with GPS coordinates showing that they were not, in fact, at his house. They did not, in fact, burn up in the arson. And he was not only going to be charged with arson, but probably other things to include financial fraud. So that was great. I wrote up my report. I submit my report. This goes to trial. And who has to go testify? Yep, little old Andre. I had to go testify. So I went to court. And I remember this like yesterday because the courtroom I was in was super small. And I was sitting here. You know, I got sworn in. And literally, if I turned to my left, like about 3 feet away was the jury box with all the jurors sitting there. Like, I could have shook their hand. That's how close I was to them. So I get asked a question by the prosecutor to, you know, elaborate about my report, about what I found with these images and the GPS coordinates. And I just felt really good at the time, right? He asked me the question. I turned. I stared at the jury the whole time as I gave my answer. I explained, I found these photos. You know, they had GPS coordinates. The GPS came back to the family member's house. So that's where they were taken. All of this stuff. And then I turned back when I was done giving my answer and looked at the attorney. And then, you know, we moved on with our day and we got the conviction and we won. But it was a really good feeling. Finding that information, treasure trove, GPS, getting this guy convicted. I mean, think about this guy. He was so brazen. He could have killed people starting this fire in a townhome complex, right? All because he was, I think, going through a divorce at the time or separating. He wanted money. He thought this was a quick, easy way to make some money. But he didn't get away with it, and thankfully, he didn't kill anybody.
Yeah, wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Just real quick, Andre, I was going to say, like, it's kind of probably seems like a thankless job or industry that you're in doing all this stuff, seeing all these different things. So taking that win there has got to be, you know, huge for you guys.
Yeah, you don't always win all your cases. And actually, when you're a forensic examiner in law enforcement, oftentimes you don't even know what the final deposition or disposition is in a case.
Okay, sure.
Unless you go look it up, right? Because you're not testifying in most of these cases. The detective or the prosecutor isn't necessarily coming to you when the case is over and saying, "Hey, Andre, guess what happened?" You know, it's just everyone's moving along. So sometimes you don't even know what happened. So it's nice to know what happened in a case and know that the work you did actually benefited and got justice.
Yeah, that's really cool.
That's got to be, thrilling. You know, maybe some adrenaline when you're there and finding those items. You mentioned, you know, you work with, you know, in the corporate sector, you work with attorneys and HR people, but you had mentioned to me, you're kind of working in a chain of command when you're working with law enforcement, correct? You're there with the officers and you're sworn in.
Correct. Yeah. So yeah, when you're in law enforcement doing this work, generally, the forensics people are reporting up to like a sergeant or a lieutenant that are in the official command structure, right? That's generally how most law enforcement agencies work. There are some slight differences here and there, but that's generally how it works. And, you know, oftentimes the people you're reporting up to, I mean, their background is law enforcement, right? They came up through the ranks. They don't necessarily know a lot about forensics, but they're managing you and managing the forensics team. So you really have to develop a close relationship with them and educate them and and try to get on the same page so that, you know, you can really be effective doing this work.
Yeah, that sounds exciting. You had mentioned another case that you worked on that involved some creative thinking. You'd mentioned a narcotics case that was particularly interesting in that regard. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right. Yeah, this is another case that I absolutely loved working, and I love talking about it. This is a good illustration of not only the power of digital forensics, but the power of having a well-rounded investigative, I guess, mind and mindset and pulling from different disciplines to get to your answer. And you'll see that once I walk you through this particular case. So yes, there was a narcotics investigation that I was involved in. So in this particular investigation, a bunch of devices were seized. This was another investigation I was not on scene for, but the devices were collected by other law enforcement agents and brought back to the laboratory. And there was one particular phone that they collected. It was a smartphone. And evidently the suspect in this case, even though this phone was found at their residence along with a bunch of other stuff, suspect said, I don't have any clue whose phone that is. I've never seen that phone before. I don't know anything about that phone. I've never touched that phone, never used that phone. Probably someone that's been in the house. I got people in and out of the house all the time, right? Parties and, you know, all this stuff going on. Someone left it here. I don't know what you're talking about. It's not my phone. Okay, well, that's fine. I guess we're gonna see if we can figure out whose phone it is, right? That's our job. So once again, the detective comes knocking and says, hey, Andre, I got a phone for you. Got a new case. Gives me the background on the narcotics case, what they did up to that point. And I got the phone. You know, again, chain of custody, all that good stuff followed. I have the phone in my little hands, ready to operate on it. So this particular phone, I do remember it was an Android phone, I'm pretty sure. Again, did a normal collection using Cellebrite, got the extraction. On this particular case, I don't remember if it was a logical or a physical, doesn't really matter, but I got an extraction on the phone, started examining the data on the phone. Step through doing the same things we always do. You're checking communications, images, videos, internet history, right? You're trying to find links to other things that you know about the case and the individual, trying to figure out what's going on. So once again, this is a case that involves images. Thankfully, everyone likes taking photos of everything these days, right? I mean, everything. So there's all kinds of photos on these phones, and it's oftentimes good information, right? So I'm scrolling through all these images, and there's all kinds of images on this phone, you know, pictures of friends and cars and all kinds of stuff. But I was scrolling through, and I stopped, and I found something that I thought was kind of interesting. It was a picture of a hand with some drugs in the middle of the hand. Okay, you could tell they were drugs, right? In a hand. And I'm like, wow, that's kind of weird. I mean, it's a drug case. It's a narcotics case, right? Okay, there's some drugs. There's a hand. But I'm looking around the phone. I'm looking at communications and other things and not really finding anything else that I can really grab onto, right? So that's not good enough for me, right? I got to figure something out here. So I go back to that image with the drugs on the hand. So I blow the image up on the screen and I realize that, wow, this is a really high resolution image. I mean, the ridge detail on the fingerprints and the palm where the drugs wasn't sitting. I mean, it was really good. And I was like, huh, that's interesting. I wonder. And I was thinking, picked up the phone and I called down to our latent fingerprint examiner and I said, hey, I have an idea here. Can you help me out? I have this image. I printed it out from a phone image. Can you run that for me? You think, will that work? And he's like, yeah, I think so. Come on down. So I scurry on down the steps and I hand him the image and he starts doing his work. Now, I have other things to do. So I'm like, okay, I appreciate your help. Let me know if you find anything. I go back upstairs, back up to the lab and start working. And later that day, you know, ding, 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 I get a call from him. Hey, I have a hit. I'm like, yes, you got a hit. So I scurry back down there to get my information. And lo and behold, the hit, a name. Who do you think, which name do you think I got back? Well, it was the name of our suspect, right? That same guy. I don't know whose phone this is. I've never seen it before. I have no idea. Blah, 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 blah.
Yahtzee.
Yeah. So I took that information. I took it to the detective working the case. I do remember the detective working the case was kind of astounded that we were able to do that and find that information and tie that phone to him with his fingerprints and with the picture of those drugs in his hand, right? And yeah, that was a big, big win for the detective, a big win for the case, definitely helped the case, you know, proved he was a liar, proved that he had drugs in his hand. But regardless, we at least at a minimum tied that phone back to him. And then we did find some other stuff eventually on the phone that was a little incriminating, and now we could tie that phone back to him. So that was a big, big win. So in this particular case, right, it was not just me working on this, but it was, you know, it was two forensic disciplines, right? Latent fingerprint examiner and digital forensic examiner. We were combining our skills working this case together. And this is one of those things where, especially if you're a new examiner getting into this field, if you're working, it doesn't matter if you're working law enforcement or not, but try to be creative. You have to think outside the box sometimes. What other things can I do or other teams I can pull from, other expertise I can use to further my case, right? To further my investigation. And I'm just happy in this particular case it all worked out, and it makes for a great story even years later.
Andre, I remember, and that is a great story, and that would be a fun one around the Thanksgiving table too. I remember a couple of years ago, I don't remember if it was a Krebs article or where I read it, but with the advancement of digital cameras getting into like the 8K range, I remember there was a proof of concept where you could take a picture of someone from relatively far away and have the resolution high enough that you could print out their fingerprint and use it to get into biometric devices. So that's pretty cool that you essentially did the same thing to actually catch a criminal in the act.
Yeah, I mean, you know, technology can be our friend in these investigations, but you have to, again, you have to know how to navigate things, and sometimes you have to be creative, right?
Andre, if we could, I'd like to shift from the Tales from the Trenches stories to see if you could tell us a little bit about this book that you're writing. You told me a bit about it, and obviously you're a, you know, at least statewide authority, Midwest authority in digital forensics, so you seem like you're in a good position to write the book. Tell us about the book and the process and what you're kind of aiming to accomplish with it.
I was actually reached out to by a publisher several years back. They evidently found a couple write-ups that I did for an online magazine. And then they reached out to me, got a hold of me, and asked me if I might be interested in writing a book about the topic of, you know, digital forensics and specifically laboratory management. So, you know, I was humbled that someone would reach out to me and ask me about that. You know, so we talked about it, pitched some ideas back and forth, did some research. You know, is there anything else in the market? There really wasn't much. There's one book, and I think till today, there's still only that really that one book out there, and it hasn't been updated in many years. You know, we negotiated a contract, started doing some work. This was pre-COVID. Then COVID hit, and kind of things stalled out on both sides, the publisher side, my side, but we've since resurrected that, and I'm in the final stages of finishing this book up. This book is going to be how to start up a digital forensics laboratory and how to manage a digital forensics laboratory. So whether you already have one or not, Hopefully there'll be some tips and tricks in there to help everybody out, whether you're new or whether you're an established lab. There's going to be chapters on just about everything you can think of, a chapter on networking, on software, on hardware, a chapter on accreditation, if you're seeking accreditation or if you are accredited. I'm going to have a chapter on kind of the quick and the easy, I think, something like that I'm calling it. But it's, you know, if you don't have a lot of money, you don't have a lot of time, you don't have a lot of resources, but you need to set something up, you know, what can I do? How can I get started? And then how can I plan to expand over time? I'm going to talk about infrastructure, environmental controls, how you manage your staff, train your staff, implement training programs. So it's going to be a pretty much all-inclusive beginning to end what you need to do to either start up or manage a digital forensics laboratory. And I'm hoping that some people will find it helpful. Yeah, I'm super excited. It's been fun writing it. I think the hardest part really isn't writing. I mean, I think fast. I type fast. I type like 80 words a minute. I can type out a chapter in like no time, but the real hard work that I'm finding is doing the additional research, like, you know, putting charts in there and finding other things, resources to connect, you know, to engage the reader, to develop my own, you know, images and stuff to stick into the chapters. That's really the challenging piece. The writing it isn't too bad, but putting this book together with all the other things you have to do, that's a bit challenging, but at least I have a publisher that will help me along the way. And, you know, they do all the editing and all, you know, all the grammar and spell checking and formatting. I just have to throw the information together and shoot it on over to them.
Awesome. That sounds like a labor of love and a lot of fun and blood, sweat, and tears as well put into it. I'm still waiting for my advanced publication copy.
Yeah, we'll see about that. We'll talk about that at coffee, Scott.
All right, sounds good.
Andre, when you finish that book and you do have it out, we'd love to have you back on the podcast to kind of do a deep dive into your book and the process and that topic as well, and help promote it as well. So keep us in the loop on that, please.
Yep, absolutely. Thank you.
So we're going a little long today, but I think that's great because this has been a really entertaining episode. There's one more main point I'd like to hit, and that's, you know, we're all about keeping ourselves and our loved ones safe online. And to that extent, you know, maybe you could give us some information on kind of the big elephant in the room, you know, when you have our kids online. How do we keep them safe? What are you seeing, you know, with law enforcement? Maybe you have a story about, you know, some exploitation that you've seen that can shed some light on really what's going on there and why it's so important to keep our children safe online and ourselves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This is extremely important and close to my, near and dear to my heart, because I worked these cases for many years. I'm going to start out, Joshua, with saying something that I told you when we met the other day. When I went to Illinois and worked with the Illinois Attorney General's office, one of the first things our chief told me when I got there, we were having a conversation, was that there's estimated to be, this was in Illinois at the time, this was 2012, 2013 timeframe, there was estimated to be between 5,000 and 6,000 child predators online in the state of Illinois. There's ways law enforcement knows about that, right? Because there's certain things they do, but that was the estimate. Now, Illinois is a big state, right? Populous state, right? Not every state is like that, but I would say if you take that number down to, let's just say 2,000, and you average that across 50 states, that's 100,000 child predators online at any given time with nothing better to do than to target children all day and all night on every single platform that's out there, whether it's Twitter, YouTube, you name it, they're there. You know, they're pretending to be young girls, young boys. They're saying all the right things, right? So that's scary, right? That's scary to know that there's that many people out there actively looking in pursuing children, which in their eyes, children are prey, right? So the internet is one big hunting ground, and their prey are all over, and they're looking for them. They're targeting them. So now that I've scared everyone, right, because that is scary when you start thinking about that, you know, what can you do? What should you do, right? I mean, I'm sure a lot of parents out there, like, you know, well, I don't know what to do. You know, there's computers and phones and everything all over the place. What do I do with my children? Well, you know, Andre has some advice, right? Andre advice is, some of this is pretty obvious, but in your own home, right, you really need to control access to your digital devices with your children, right? I would recommend limiting or eliminating any kind of screen time in their bedrooms or in private areas of your house. Nothing good ever comes from that. You know, have those devices out in public areas in your house, like the living room, the dining room, your media room where you're hanging out watching movies, whatever it is, but have them use those devices, you know, in an open area. That's a suggestion. You know, I know a lot of parents allow use in their bedrooms, but you don't really know what's going on when that door is closed, right? The other thing is, there's plenty of tools these days to limit access to the internet within your home, right? You can implement different software devices and even hardware devices that will limit access to sites, limit the amount of time your child can spend on a device, and then it'll time out and they can't go out to the internet any longer. All of these things are good, and you can find free and cheap options out there to help you set, you know, get those things in place to help protect your children. The other thing, and again, this is an obvious thing, but, you know, have some conversations with your children, right? Talk to them about internet safety. Talk to them about what data they should and shouldn't be sharing. You know, don't share information about where you go to school. You know, don't give out your address, obviously. I mean, for the most part, don't even talk about what state and city you live in to people you don't know. These predators out there, they're trying to gather as much information they can on a target, right? And then they'll go out and they'll Google search, and they'll pull in other information. They'll go out and look for yearbooks, and they'll do all of these things to try to find this person, this kid that they're targeting. So although these little bits of information may seem, you know, innocuous to a child, that predator is taking all of these pieces of information, combining it, and think about this. They're doing an investigation on their prey. Right? That's what they're doing. And they're putting together this case file with all of this information so that they can take their next step. So talk with your children. Just say, you know, make sure you know what they're doing. I suggest too, if your children is into gaming, and, you know, maybe learn how to play their favorite game with them once in a while so you know what they're doing and you understand what they're doing in the chat services. Because this is another big area that I don't think parents understand. It's not just these websites children go to, but if you're playing these games through like your Xbox or your PlayStation, they often have chat services built in and other things built in, and the children are getting tied up with that. They're playing the game, and then they're saying, oh yeah, you know, blah blah blah, I'm going down to the Dairy Queen down off Main Street, and blah blah blah, you know, I'm meeting up with my friend Sherry. And again, the predator is taking all this information, putting it into their case file, and they're targeting that child, and they're going to try to do something. Get that child to send them nude photographs, get that child to meet them somewhere. Whatever the case may be, it's never something that's good. So, again, I can't emphasize enough, just know what your children are doing. Be involved in their lives. Talk to them. Show some interest in what they're interested in so that they'll open up to you and talk to you about things. But, yeah, combine that with, you know, some parental controls that I talked about. Also, as far as those controls go, you can also get cheap VPN services that will help at least obfuscate some of your information on the internet. You know, there's, you know, Nord, Proton, ExpressVPN. Those will help too. But ultimately, your child is the one giving up all of the important information. And that's what you really need to try to control. And you know, it's not easy, right? And children outside of the home, right? How do you know what they're doing, right? How do you know where they're going? Well, I would highly recommend you have some kind of tracking device on their phone if you have a young child. There's no doubt about it, because if something does happen, you know, maybe there's a chance you'll at least know where they're at. I can tell you one just quick story. I know we're over, but I think this is a good story. Back in the day with my stepdaughter, we had a computer. We had it in a family room. She would chat with her friends, send emails, do that kind of stuff. I had some software on there that recorded literally every action on the computer, did screenshots. It did everything. And one day she was like, oh, yeah, I want to, you know, Friday night, I want to go hang out with my friend and blah, blah, blah. So I checked some of her chats because it's something that wasn't really sitting right with me. And she was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to tell Andre and Mom that I'm coming over to your place, but then I'm going to go hang out with this person. We're going to go do this. And so it was this big scheme for her to go do something else, which potentially would have put her into some dangerous situations. And then when she came to ask us, hey, can I go do this on Friday? You know, I was armed with that information. I didn't tell her that I knew what she was up to, but, you know, we just told her, no, you can't. We have something else going on and you can't go. But again, that's just one small example, but know what your children are doing and don't be afraid that people are going to say you're spying on your children. No, you're trying to keep them safe, and you know, you have to do what you have to do. And this is not the same world that we had in 1990 or 1980 or 1950. This is a different world. And there's things you can do to protect your children.
Are there any other, you know, stories that just show how important it is, you know, to stay up on this with your children?
Well, I mean, again, I worked a lot of these CP cases. And I'll just say this. There is no such thing as an average predator. You know, what they look like, what they do for a living, they're all over the place. They've been grandpas that have nice homes in the suburbs. They've been kind of wackadoodle gamers with filthy bedrooms and monitors mounted above their bed and everything in between. So you just never know who the predator is. Again, look at Jared Fogle, right? A Subway spokesperson. Did anyone have any clue Jared was doing what he did? I mean, his wife didn't even have a clue from what it seems. I mean, you just don't know, right? So again, just want to let everybody know they come in all shapes and sizes, these predators. They can be anywhere at any given time. They could be in your own home and you not even know it because they're secretive. They hide their activity. I will say, speaking of hiding their activity, I will say one quick story here just because it's entertaining, and Scott's heard this one several times. So we were serving a search warrant, and I was on this search warrant, and it was a very high upper class suburb that we were in, very nice homes. And we served the search warrant on a house. We went in, and the suspect in this particular case was an older gentleman. He was in, I believe, like his late 60s. You know, grandpa, had children, had a wife, had grandkids, all of this stuff. And we were searching. He had a fully finished basement, a huge room down there. He had his computer down there. Couches, all of this stuff. And we were doing a search. The interesting thing about the room was it had a drop ceiling, right? Above it with little tiles. And one of our detectives that was in full SWAT gear at the time when we went in there got a little stepladder and was going to, you know, look in the tiles. And I kid you not, this was a huge room, probably, you know, 100 or so tiles, right? Drop ceiling tiles all over the place. It was just a big room. The first tile he popped, the first tile he moved, he looked, and I remember he looked back at all of us. There was probably like 8 of us in the room, and big smile on his face. And he was probably about 5'8", kind of a stocky guy, weighed like probably like 240 on this little step stool. And he started doing this little dance. And he said, I hit the mother load. And he pointed up there and we looked. And there was probably like 100 CDs and DVDs stashed up in the drop ceiling. And of course, you know, we inventoried all that. And eventually, yes, all of that stuff did have exploitive material on it, right? But we all broke out like kind of a roar and we were all laughing. And because, it was just a good feeling that we found it. And it was kind of funny the way he found it. So the chief is interviewing the suspect upstairs, and he runs down the stairs, and he looks at us, and he's like, what the heck's going on? You need to keep it down, blah, blah, blah. And someone, I can't remember who, said, Chief, we found it. We found the stash. And the chief just had this huge smile on his face all of a sudden, so he went from, you know, ripping us one to this big smile, and then he just said, well, keep it down. And then he ran back upstairs to finish his interview because now he knew we had the goods. He could change his style of in the interview. But, you know, it was just, it's a good feeling when you find stuff like that, when you're doing these investigations and you serve a search warrant. Not every search warrant you serve is productive. You don't always find what you want to find, right? But that one, we found it, first tile, and, it was just funny. Maybe a little funnier when you were there than me telling it, but, it was a good time, and I'll always remember that, that particular search warrant.
Andre, with these predators, is it 99.9% of the time men, or are there ever any women involved with your investigations?
Yeah, that is an excellent question. Yes, it in my personal experience, it is almost exclusively men, but not always. There was one particular case that I wasn't directly involved in, but I was working with the examiner who was working on it, and that was one where a mother was involved with exploiting their own child. And yeah, it was a horrible, horrible case. So that particular one, obviously a woman was involved, but the vast majority of these things are men. But there are some sick and depraved women out there too, but it's mostly men.
And Andre, I know we're probably all expressing the same thing. Really appreciate what you're doing here to help, clean up the internet, so to speak. I'm sure there's things that you've seen that you just can't unsee. And I'm sure that's hard, but really appreciate you sharing these stories here with us today, too.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime. Glad to share. Glad to offer, up my experience to all of those out there. And I'll come back anytime, share more stories. I got plenty more to share. Unfortunately, but some of them are interesting.
Andre, we like to send our guests off with some IT Audit Labs swag. So if you could let us know your head and clothing sizes,
I told you that yesterday, Scott.
Did you? Sorry, I'm just doing it for the camera here.
Did I tell you what size I am?
Just doing it for the camera.
just showing how good we are with our guests, so we get you back and we get other quality guests. But yes, you did tell me, Andre, what size you were. I'd have to read it off of the message, though.
You can feel free. I'm not proud, but it's the truth is the truth.
We'll send you something.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, we'll get you something out. In the current technology landscape, managing risk, among other operations, can be incredibly challenging. Let IT Audit Labs experts provide a detailed, thorough examination in preparation for your upcoming audit. Contact us to learn more. Thanks to our producer, Joshua J. Schmidt, and our audio-video editor, Cameron Troy Hill.